Usually when you analyze a military siege, you are looking at a pretty terrifyingly simple mathematical equation.
Right, it's just a calculation of weight, mass, and time at the end of the day.
Exactly. You have, say, 3,000 heavily armed attackers on the outside, maybe 500 defenders on the inside. And the math just inexorably grinds down to one inevitable bloody conclusion.
Yeah, because the math doesn't really care about heroism or, desperation. It simply calculates the attrition until the defending walls are breached or the food runs out.
But then you step into the world of asymmetrical warfare, and suddenly that terrible equation starts to crack a little bit.
Oh, absolutely, it does.
Because for today's deep dive, we are looking at a really fascinating set of battle logs and narratives from the realm of Mirari. We're specifically centering on the Palace of All Seasons.
And we should establish right away the situation here is dire.
Beyond dire, the palace is under a massive two-front siege by the forces of this dark entity known as the Destroyer.
Right, so on the Western Front, you have 3,000 trolls, ogres, and goblins building these massive siege engines in the freezing snow.
Yeah, and then on the Eastern Front, 2,000 undead liches and zombies who are literally corrupting the ground they walk on. And inside the walls, less than 600 defenders.
They are entirely cut off, vastly outnumbered, and facing total annihilation from two completely different vectors of attack.
Which is exactly what makes our mission for today's deep dive so incredibly compelling. We are going to extract the thrilling tactical maneuvers these defenders use to turn the tables on a 5,000-strong army.
It's a masterclass in strategy, really.
It is. But more than that, we are going to explore the deep metaphysical world-building hidden just beneath the surface of this conflict. Because to understand how a force of a few hundred survives against impossible odds, you have to look past the swords and the shields.
Right, you have to look at the psychological vulnerabilities of the enemy. You have to exploit the very way the enemy organizes themselves.
Yeah, and we get to see exactly how that works when we zoom in from the macro scale of a 5,000-strong army down to the micro level of a single operative infiltrating enemy lines.
Oh, Knight Redmayne.
Yes. Let's talk about how she infiltrates the Troll War Camp. Redmayne and her steed, Ahern, who, by the way, happens to be the magical lord of horses. They don't just sneak in under the cover of darkness.
No, they use a highly sophisticated illusion magic called glamour. But this isn't just a simple visual trick.
Right, it's way more immersive than that.
Exactly. Glamour alters perception on multiple sensory levels. So Ahern projects this aura of absolute filth and rot, while Redmayne disguises herself as a terrifying, high-ranking dark commander known as the Iron Bearer.
And she just struts right up to an ogre foreman and a goblin craftsman who
Yeah.
are in the middle of constructing this massive 25-foot-tall wooden siege tower.
She walks directly into the center of the enemy's logistical hub and immediately establishes dominance. I mean, she kicks the wagon wheel of this towering structure and aggressively tells them it's going to collapse under its own weight.
And this is the crazy part, she manipulates them into sabotaging their own equipment.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
She convinces them to strip off their heavy defenses. Specifically, their arbalests, which are these massive mounted crossbows used for anti-siege defense. She tells them to do it just to, quote, lighten the load of the tower.
And while she has them completely off balance, she casually drops a psychological landmine. She tells the ogre to ignore any rumors he might hear about 500 fire-breathing griffins defending the city.
I love that. Planting the seed of panic while explicitly telling them not to panic.
It is a textbook piece of social engineering.
And the absolute climax of this infiltration, she demands that the siege crew test fire a trebuchet blindly into the dark. They actually comply, and those massive stones land a perfect hit right on the enemy's own central command center.
It's a devastating blow, and she didn't even have to light the fuse.
Okay, let's unpack this. She is in an enemy camp, and she orders an ogre to literally bomb his own bosses. How does that not instantly blow her cover?
You'd think it would, right?
Right. I mean, you would think an enemy general would immediately realize, hey, a spy just ordered our own artillery to fire on us. It seems like a dead giveaway.
Well, what's fascinating here is that to understand why this works, you have to look at the specific organizational mechanics of the Dark Army.
Okay, lay it on me.
Redmayne isn't just taking advantage of the fact that ogres might be dull-witted. She is actively weaponizing their hierarchy. This dark army runs entirely on fear and rigid authoritarianism.
So nobody questions anyone above them.
Exactly. The goblin craftsman, for instance, actually knows the siege tower is structurally sound, but he is fundamentally too terrified of the ogre foreman to correct him.
And the ogre is too terrified of the iron bearer to question these bizarre orders.
Precisely. In a fear-based organization, information simply stops flowing upward. Mistakes are buried. No one wants to be the messenger who brings bad news to a volatile boss.
Oh, wow. So when Redmayne orders them to fire on their own command center?
She provides a built-in rationalization. She claims the tents they are firing at are actually a decoy camp set up by their dark master to fool city spies.
And the ogre just buys it.
The ogre accepts this without hesitation because believing the Iron Bearer is vastly safer for his own survival than questioning her. Obedience is rewarded, but critical thinking is punished with death.
Man, fear-based hierarchies are incredibly fragile to confident misdirection from the top down, aren't they?
They really are. And that structural fragility is what allows a single knight to cripple a siege engine and bombard the enemy's command tent without drawing a sword.
You know, psychological sabotage only buys you a window of opportunity. Once that command tent is crushed, chaos erupts, sure, but you still have 3,000 angry trolls and goblins who are eventually going to figure out what happened.
Right, you have to translate that psychological fracture into kinetic energy. You need a physical force multiplier to really capitalize on that confusion.
Which brings us to the coordinated counterattack. Redmayne slips out of the confused camp and links up with Mirari's hidden reinforcements waiting in the surrounding woods.
And this force includes Maze archers led by Sir Gawain and Sir Theodore's cavalry.
Yes, and Theodore's cavalry is amazing. It's composed of these massive, bear-like knights riding into battle. So they execute a hit-and-run strategy designed to draw the maximum amount of attention.
Which is incredibly risky.
It is. Redmayne even engages in a highly visible one-on-one duel with a Vaglori.
The armored scorpion man.
Yeah, a terrifying, heavily armored creature that serves as shock infantry. She lances it right through the heart, leaving it smoldering in the snow.
And this isn't just about taking out one strong combatant, right? It is a deliberate provocation.
Exactly. It totally enrages the enemy horde. Mm-hmm. Ahern, the horse, fakes a limp, and they successfully draw this massive, screaming army of trolls and ogres out of the woods and straight into a narrow ravine.
Which is a classic funneling tactic, relying entirely on the enemy's momentum.
That's exactly the concept. When an army of 3,000 troops is funneled into a choke point, the ones in the back keep pushing forward, creating this massive crush.
Right. Their numerical advantage is completely neutralized because only the front line can actually engage.
Yes. And once the enemy completely fills that ravine, Sir Theodore's heavy cavalry hits them from the flank. It creates a shockwave that absolutely crushes the trapped trolls.
It's a brutal, brilliant ground trap.
But what elevates this from a standard ambush is what happens simultaneously overhead. High above this bloody ground trap flies the Black Boat, this magical flying wooden yacht.
Piloted by Princess Angel, the Lord Explorer, Thomas, and Rachel.
Right. And they are flying directly over the goblin work camp that Redmayne just sabotaged. Thomas drops a glass oil lamp onto the weakened siege tower below, and Rachel shoots the falling lamp with a flaming crossbow quarrel.
The timing on that is just incredible.
It really is. The oil ignites, the tower bursts into an inferno, and goblins are leaping 30 feet into the snow to escape the flames. And what are they shouting?
Oh, they are screaming about the fire-breathing Gryphon.
Yes. The rumor Redmayne planted has just manifested in their reality.
It's the perfect psychological payoff.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The ground trap in the ravine makes perfect tactical sense. You are using their own mass against them. But I have to question the logic of the aerial strike.
Why is that?
Well, flying a highly visible, slow-moving wooden boat right over active siege weaponry seems incredibly reckless. I mean, it only takes one stray rock from an arbalest or a catapult, and your crucial flying asset is completely shattered.
That's a fair point. It is a massive vulnerability. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, look at the dual vector pressure the defenders are applying.
Okay, interesting.
You have horizontal pressure crushing the enemy in the ravine and vertical pressure raining fire from the sky. The objective of dropping that oil lamp isn't merely to destroy a single piece of wood.
Right. It's bigger than that.
It is the final mechanism needed to deploy the psychological virus Redmayne engineered.
The fear of the Gryphons.
Yes. Redmayne planted the idea, but the Black Boat provides the physical proof. An army can endure heavy casualties in a ravine if they understand the parameters of the fight.
Sure, they can process a cavalry charge.
Exactly. But the terror of the unknown, the belief that mythical, fire-breathing monsters are now picking them off from the darkness above that shatters their cohesion completely. Panic moves through an army much faster than a cavalry charge.
Wow. So the Black Boat traded the physical risk of flying low for the massive psychological reward of breaking the enemy's mind.
Precisely. But, you know, winning a skirmish in the mud and the snow only buys your city precious time.
Right. Winning a battle outside the walls doesn't secure the kingdom's future if the leadership inside the walls is fractured.
And that is exactly where we find ourselves next.
Yeah, we transition now from the kinetic warfare of the ravine to the tense, paranoid atmosphere of the war room inside the Palace of All Seasons.
This is where the nature of the conflict fundamentally shifts from military tactics to intelligence and metaphysics.
The Black Boat lands safely in the courtyard, and there's a deeply emotional reunion. Queen Seraph is reunited with her brother, Lord April,
who was the true heir to the throne, finally rescued from the destroyer's captivity.
Right. But the environment they bring him back to is suffocatingly paranoid. The royal court is terrified of shapeshifters infiltrating their ranks. They just cannot trust their own eyes.
Which requires an objective mechanism for verification.
And that mechanism comes from Nimue the Sorceress. She uses a device called an opticon.
It's sort of like a magical camera, right?
Yeah, exactly. It functions like a camera, creating a brilliant flash of light to capture an image of the reunion. Because magic in Mirari often deals with uncovering hidden truths, the opticon strips away any potential glamour or illusion.
Oh, that's incredibly smart.
It is. The resulting image reveals the pure, unfiltered pain and love on the faces of Seraph and April, definitively proving that the Lord is exactly who he claims to be.
It really highlights how deeply the dark forces have compromised the defender's sense of reality, doesn't it? I mean, they need magical technology just to trust a hug between siblings.
That is so true. The atmosphere remains heavy as they move into the queen's sitting room. It is this beautiful space, decorated with ocean tapestries and glowing pearls, a really stark contrast to the slaughter happening just outside the walls.
Right, a brief moment of calm.
And it is in this quiet room that Lord Explorer Thomas casually drops a silver pen onto the table.
A seemingly innocuous object.
But the backstory is staggering. Thomas reveals that while he was infiltrating the destroyer's dark keep to rescue Lord April, he stole this silver pen directly off the desk of a wraith.
A wraith being a dark, parasitic spirit serving the enemy.
Exactly. And this isn't just any writing tool. This is the very pen the dark forces use to draft magical contracts, signing mortal souls over into the destroyer's eternal service.
Didn't he just took it?
Yeah, he even jokes that he managed to swipe it when a lizard dropped into his boot, distracting the wraith.
Unbelievable.
So what does this all mean? Thomas has essentially stolen the ultimate villain's magical contract pen and brought it directly into the heart of Mirari's only remaining safe haven.
It's a bold move.
My initial reaction is that this is like stealing a tracking device from an enemy intelligence agency and hiding it under your own mattress. Is he recklessly carrying a live grenade right into their bunker?
Well, it certainly carries an existential level of risk. The dark forces will undoubtedly tear the world apart looking for it. But you have to view this through Thomas's specific operational philosophy.
Which is what, exactly?
He understands that to defeat an overwhelmingly powerful asymmetrical threat like the Destroyer, you cannot just fight their foot soldiers. You must actively deprive the enemy of their core infrastructure.
Ah, I see.
By stealing the pen, he hasn't just taken a weapon. He has stolen their administrative capability to harvest souls.
He essentially stole the password to their database.
Essentially, yes. And as the conversation in the Queen's sitting room quickly reveals, the pen's significance goes far beyond just drafting dark contracts.
It does.
Yeah, this silver pen is a foundational artifact. It is intricately tied to the creation and the governing physics of their entire world.
Oh, wow. This brings us to the biggest revelation of the entire narrative. The silver pen forces everyone, the characters, and us as the audience, to look way beyond the tactical map of the siege.
Right. The scope of the conflict expands exponentially in this single conversation.
We realize this war isn't just a dispute over territory or a throne. It is a battle for the metaphysical source code of the universe itself.
The stakes literally couldn't be higher.
So Nimue the Sorceress and Lord Melchizedek take the floor. Melchizedek is a fascinating figure. He is a towering black unicorn and the Lord Protector of the realm.
A very heavy burden for him.
Definitely. He and Nimue begin discussing a cruel, cyclical event known as the Year's End, We learn that the timeline of Mirari isn't strictly linear. It operates on a loop.
And every time the cycle threatens to reset, the Destroyer's power surges.
Right. And to hold the Dark Entity back and preserve the realm, a terrible price must be paid. The King of Mirari usually has to die.
The system essentially requires a blood sacrifice to maintain its equilibrium.
And Thomas, the man who just stole the soul signing pen, utterly rejects this. He refuses to accept a status quo where the forces of light have to endlessly sacrifice their own leaders just to buy another year of survival.
He's not willing to play by those rules anymore.
Exactly. And that is when Melchizedek, carrying the weight of centuries, confesses the great dark secret of Mirari.
The origin of their reality.
Yes. 50 years ago, spirits from the realm of Mirari made contact with mortal children, kids named the Harcourts. And they used these children to literally write the rules of this fantasy world.
They wrote the laws of physics, magic, life, and death.
Yes, in a simple letter-bound book located in our world, the mortal realm. And the stolen silver pen, along with a magic flute and a mirror that the heroes have also uncovered, serve as the dimensional anchors to these rules.
It's mind-blowing.
It is. Think about it like a piece of buggy software. The original creators coded this terrible, flawed operating system where it only reboots if you delete the core file, the king.
A terrible design.
Right. So Thomas is essentially acting as a rogue hacker here.
Mm.
Why accept that buggy code when you've just stolen the original developer tools, the silver pen? He wants to take it and rewrite the OS entirely.
This raises an important question, and it is the philosophical core of these sources. You have two contrasting ideologies sitting in that room debating the future of their reality.
Let's hear it.
On one side, you have Lord Melchizedek. He admits with profound grief that he has facilitated the sacrifice of 50 kings and queens to the pages of history over 50 years to keep the realm safe.
That is just a staggering amount of guilt to carry.
It is. He represents the ultimate conservative approach to systems management. He maintains a system that is undeniably cruel, fundamentally broken, but it is stable. It keeps the universe from collapsing.
It's the burden of keeping the lights on no matter the cost.
Exactly the tragic burden he bears. But on the other side, you have Thomas representing radical disruption. He looks at a system that requires the constant mechanized sacrifice of human life and says the stability is no longer worth the cost.
The rules are wrong, so the rules must be rewritten.
Exactly. This is a profound exploration of systems thinking. When you analyze a fundamentally broken system, whether that is a geopolitical structure, an economic model, or even a technological framework, at what point does the cost of maintaining the status quo outweigh the catastrophic risk of tearing down the infrastructure and starting over?
It's the ultimate dilemma of asymmetric strategy. Do you keep playing a rigged game, hoping to optimize your moves within a flawed rulebook? Or do you flip the board, steal the pen, and accept the chaos that comes with writing your own rules?
Melchizedek chose to optimize the flawed rulebook for 50 years because he feared the chaos of the alternative. Thomas is choosing the chaos.
And it perfectly encapsulates the incredible escalation of this journey we've been on today. We started it in the mud and the freezing snow, analyzing the gritty kinetic tactics of Night Redmayne.
Right. We saw how she weaponized the rigid hierarchy of a goblin camp, turning the enemy's psychological flaws into physical artillery fire.
Yeah. And we watched the defenders apply dual vector pressure, combining a ground-level cavalry funnel with a terrifying aerial strike from the Black Boat.
Moving seamlessly from the mechanics of warfare to the mechanics of reality.
Exactly. We moved into the paranoid, insulated halls of the Palace of All Seasons, where the theft of a single silver pen completely shifted the paradigm of the war.
It changed everything.
We arrived at the staggering realization that the heroes of Mirari are no longer just trying to win a battle against 3,000 trolls. They are preparing to hack the metaphysical source code of their universe.
Because they recognize that outsmarting the enemy on the battlefield is pointless if the universe itself is programmed to demand their destruction at the year's end.
Which is really the core insight to take away from this deep dive for you, the listener. Whenever you are dealing with an overwhelming competitor, a toxic workplace, or a deeply entrenched system where the odds are just stacked against you, look at the underlying architecture.
Don't just fight harder within the current parameters.
Right. True asymmetric victory comes from having the audacity to question the parameters themselves. It comes from identifying the rules that govern the game, locating the tools that wrote those rules, and taking control of the narrative.
It is the ultimate evolution of strategy, moving from a player on the board to the designer of the board.
Absolutely. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final, lingering thought to mull over on your own.
Okay, let's hear it.
We talked about the great secret of Mirari, that the absolute fundamental rules of their magical realm, the laws governing life, death, and time itself, were originally written by mortal children.
Yes, written in a simple leather-bound book located in our world, the physical anchor of their entire reality, just sitting somewhere in the mundane world.
Which begs a deeply unsettling question. Where is that leather-bound book right now? Is it sitting forgotten on a dusty shelf in a used bookstore? Is it packed away in a cardboard box in an attic somewhere?
It could be anywhere.
It really could. And what happens to the world of Mirari if someone in our world finds it today, opens it up, and just decides to start crossing things out?